Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC, 12 minutes after 9 o'clock on a very warm Wednesday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. It's our Roundtable panel, and today's panel, it's an all-star panel, actually. We have dueling communications consultants on the panel, Teresa Bourgeois and Joe Bonilla, both here today. They're next to each other. Could be some trouble. Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith is here, and WAMC's Alan Shartok. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What is going on with this warm weather? It's very odd.
I'm not complaining right now, but tomorrow I'll complain, definitely.
Yeah. A little snow maybe tonight, depending on where you are.
Yeah. Yep.
That's the Northeast for you, eh?
Yeah, so
it's
enjoy
the New England
it.
Way to complain, whatever change
it's
we have.
It's too warm, it's too cold, yep. It's too wet, it's too dry. It's all right.
Just enjoy it today.
Layering
that's
is
right.
The key.
I don't think Alan's too happy about the weather.
No.
Or anything else.
Quite right.
If you're unhappy, give us an email, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Try to keep your messages brief, to the point, on topic. Don't include links. Don't use abbreviations. Try to proofread. Remember, oftentimes, that the messages will be handed to Alan, and he'll read them straight through like Ron Burgundy. So make sure you proofread your emails. And no more than one email a day, please. panel@wamc.org. Kind of a sad note to start our show. The Reverend Billy Graham died this morning, 99 years old. He was America's pastor. He served presidents from Eisenhower to George W. Bush. And reached more than 200 million people through his appearances and radio and TV. Anybody want to offer an obit? Wow.
Alan?
Well, he was a good man. I think he was a good man. I think he avoided many of the pitfalls of the evangelicals who were not as open to brotherly love as he was. And, he went over a lot of boundaries and gave a lot of people a lot of hope. He was a very decent guy.
It was a good run, 99 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, and presidents of both parties did rely on him and turn to him. And I'm not quite sure how that evolved, that he became the person to go to for presidents, but he did.
He was consistent, and that's part of his enduring legacy. And I think, now it'll be an opportunity to look back and see what's changed. And, I think you'll hear a talk in the coming days and today about, why he had such appeal when he did and what's changed since then under his name and his, you kind of have to call it a brand in a way.
Well, you look at the impact he's had on other evangelical, in television and radio, going to obviously the modern day with Joel Osteen and other folks like that. So you see that impact as well. But the political impact that he's had, and actually, I believe he did counsel Obama at one point, maybe down in North Carolina, but it's truly the loss of a legend.
Yeah, and 99 years old, so rest in peace, Reverend Graham.
I'd love to see him make 100.
Well,
that didn't happen.
That's not going to happen now. I mean, he'll make 100, he just won't be alive.
Right. But he did, a lot of people, he did provide good guidance to a lot of people and avoided a lot of the pitfalls that some of these other evangelicals encountered.
President Trump is declaring that more must be done to protect America's children. With the Florida community grieving over the latest school shooting, Trump is directing the Justice Department to ban devices like the rapid-fire bump stocks used in last year's Las Vegas massacre. This afternoon, the president is hosting parents, teachers, and students for a listening session that will include people impacted by mass shootings in Parkland, Florida, and the shootings in Columbine, Colorado, and Newtown, Connecticut.
Well, I hope somebody there gets in his face. And I don't know how they select who gets to get in to talk to the president. But I tell you, some of these kids are really appropriately furious about the American political classes taking the money and not doing anything and seeing this kind of thing happening again and again. And as for the president, I don't believe a word he says. I don't believe him because, as you know, the Washington Post found him in over 2,000 lies, specific lies. He was for DACA, but then he wasn't for DACA. When they worked something out, he was not for that. So this is a guy who can take a look at the television in the morning, tweet something out, and then just be blasé about not keeping his word or not meaning anything. It's no wonder that he's rated the worst president in history in this country.
I hope that it's more than just a listening session, that that the people in attendance have an opportunity to ask good hard questions, and that they are able to hold the government accountable to some answers. Right after the incident happened, he said, "We're here for you. Anything you need." What does that look like? How is that defined? And as we hear reports about the increase of investments, not into school infrastructure, but into security, is that the right pathway? And I think I hope it brings up a long-term discussion, especially now that, you know, legislators are in Florida, in Tallahassee, in session. I hope they're listening too.
Well, Jen, I just want to respond to that for a moment. We all know how people who come into a room are picked. Mm-hmm. If you take a look at Trump at his campaign rally, you know, there's inevitably a black face which is prominently featured, maybe some guy with a turban on, which they pick who comes in there. So I think we can't expect that they haven't done their homework and figured out who's going to give them less of a hard time by being admitted into the place.
Absolutely, but you can't deny the fact that both inside and outside of the session too, there are going to be people who, you know, want to say their piece. And will there be protesters there? Around the room, I'm sure of it. And I hope, you know, there are still students who are, going to be outside the White House. We saw a line the other day. You can't just take that small sample that you've controlled. You have to listen to the wider audience.
But the problem is, it's always the inevitable and unfortunate dog and pony show of these listening tours or these meetings, because at the same time, as we've seen with this president, yeah, he can look like he's listening, but is he really hearing what the folks in that room are going to say? Mm-hmm. And that's always been the problem there. And when you come down to vetting, as we've seen with this administration, they don't necessarily vet the right way. So inevitably, very well, you could have somebody that could cause an outburst there. Mm-hmm. You never know.
Absolutely.
Well, we've seen it in the past. Who was it? Who was the African-American? Lena Horne, who got in Johnson's face. I remember that. That's one of the advantages of being a little older. And really let him have it at a receiving line. But I think for the most part, you're right, Joe, that this is preordained who's going to be in that room.
Right. I think this today is theater, and they want to change the subject. They want to change the subject away from security clearances. They want to change the subject away from the Russian issue or the tweets over the weekend or any of a range of things. And they also want to give the appearance that he's involved. But as Joe said, just like on DACA, you know, he said, "I'm for it." And then when it came down to actually enacting legislation in the Senate, they lobbied to stop that. But so I think you don't want to, you know, what's in his heart? Well, as Joe Biden says, you know, tell me what's in his budget and I'll show you what's in his heart.
Well, I mean, you can say that he has been a vocal supporter of gun rights. And so can you infer a
change?
You can
say what?
You could say that he has been a vocal supporter of gun rights, of right to bear arms.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Sorry.
So can you infer then a change in attitude by his direction yesterday that the Justice Department banned bump stocks?
No, this language is something that the NRA said that they were for, and what they want to do is pair it with a concealed carry bill. So what the NRA is trying to do is to get a concealed carry bill, a nationwide concealed carry bill through, and they're doing that by pairing it with this gun stock provision that's pretty weak. And that's all that, you know, he's this bump stock. And so this is just paired to actually, the actual purpose for this is to move through this concealed carry, nationwide concealed carry.
And the key really is that, you know, the president also said he basically instructed the attorney general to develop these regulations. So who knows how long this development phase could take. Sure. It could take a year. It could take until the end of administration.
Well, actually, it's disrupting the process because there was they began a process after Las Vegas and they had a rulemaking. So you have a comment period, and the comment period ended January 25th. And so now they're supposed to be reviewing those comments and reporting out. But this cuts into that process in some way, is going to disrupt it. And so that's the, unless, you know, they put real legislation and they pass it. But is that going to go through the House and the Senate? I don't think so. You know, you have Wayne LaPierre from the NRA speaking at the big conservative event this week. And
what would you consider to be real legislation?
Real?
Yeah.
You mean what?
Will they pass real legislation? So what would you consider that to be?
Well, you have to do you could do a range of things. You could tighten the restrictions on the time period to get a gun, waiting period, better background checks. You could actually control bump stocks. But then you could allow research on gun violence as a public health problem. That would be a simple thing to do. But then, for instance, Trump has proposed to cut $25 million or 36% from the funding for school safety activities, right? They have gutted funding for the processing for review of background checks and such. So real action would be actually funding the process for background checks. It would be actually funding and not cutting school violence programs. It would actually be funding mental health initiatives, not cutting them.
Very interesting. These guys at the NRA are tricky. Mm-hmm. As you have mentioned many times, Teresa, and other people on the panel have, this is really the gun makers and manufacturers who are putting up all of this money. And basically, I know it's a terrible word because it's a criminal word, but bribing legislators. You saw that in Tallahassee when all those kids got down there and they voted down any kind of sensible gun legislation. And when they took a look at whether these people had taken money, I think with the exception of something like three, they all had. So that money really, really talks. One of the things I'm quite afraid of is that in the rubric of how to make things better, they're going to make things worse. So, for example, the concealed carry that you mentioned. If everybody had a gun, this kind of thing wouldn't have happened. No, it would happen more. Okay. And another possibility here is let teachers have guns. Because if teachers had guns, when a madman came in, the teacher would take out his gun and blast them.
And that's a fundamentally flawed argument who's going to pay for that, first of all? Right. Who's going to, give up school time for training when they're trying to do professional development? I think one of the bigger issues, too, even beyond, what money you're giving to programs, is what money are you giving to schools to fund staff who know their students, to fix aging infrastructure? It costs so much right now just to some of the school buildings are so old they can't adapt to new security measures if you want to have these, locking vestibules and things like that. I mean, right. There are bigger
Fix
issues
the
going
roof
on.
And the heating yeah. systems.
Well, with all due respect, the teachers in Florida knew about this kid.
Mm-hmm.
They
Absolutely.
Knew quite well. This was not a question of them not knowing that he was trouble.
Well, why do you say in all due respect, Raymond? This is one guy, and we know that there are a lot of other one guys out there and who can and will certainly do this in the future. So that, yes, we have to tighten up with the FBI, but then we'll have to get a whole lot more FBI agents and others who get this kind
and
of...
Could have this been addressed locally? I mean, that's another question you ask. If the teachers knew that this student was trouble, what was the communication between them and local law enforcement? You have a kid who's experienced, who's basically has no parental guidance because both of his folks died within a similar period of time. So what social services were provided? Was there follow up? Was there,
what can you do?
Yeah. And I think that these are the issues with different systems that are in place. These are the cracks that people fall through. I mean, it, even you had a school resource officer in the school. You know, I think it, that goes, these are all part and parcel that go together in tandem with laws that say, you know, if we have someone who is disturbed, does that school resource officer then have jurisdiction to maybe, you know, detain them? Or, you know, is that a channel to work with a liaison from the Department of Children and Families to get this student in a secure, stable living condition where they wouldn't have access to what they have, instead of having someone who is out on their own with access, unsupervised, unaccounted for.
Right. But it comes down to the localities in terms of what the funding availability
Absolutely.
Would be. And obviously their regulations
and where,
there.
Where is their right. funding stream coming from? Often federally.
But right. even this very, very wealthy school district, I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but there is one counselor for every 400 some kids when it's supposed to be one for every 250.
Which is still
And even that sounds crazy. Much. But this is a wealthy school district. But the fundamental thing is, in terms of gun restrictions, I believe it's correct, if I read it correctly, that in Connecticut, this person would not have been allowed to purchase a high-powered weapon, mm-hmm. but he could in Florida. Mm-hmm. And so even if the federal government won't act because of the NRA's grip on, and let's face it, it's not just Republicans, it's Republicans and Democrats, there can be action at the state level. Now, ultimately, you need action at the federal level. But if there were tighter background checks, this young man would not have been able to, he should not have been able to purchase this gun. But this is also not unlike, you know, domestic violence cases. How many times do you hear about people know that a person is violent? They say, we have to wait till he shoots the person, often a woman, mm-hmm. he shoots her, before we can do something. People know the person needs help. And they just, they try over and over to stop it. You get a restraining order, but.
Right.
Teresa Bourgeois is on the panel today, also joined by Joe Bonilla and Jen Smith, as well as WAMC's Alan Shartok. And you can join the fun here by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org is the email address, and we'll get to some of your emails coming up. Robert Mueller reeled in another medium to small size fish, and we'll talk about that coming up. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC, 9:34, Wednesday morning, spring-like here in mid to late February. It's the Roundtable panel. We have today on the panel Joe Bonilla and Teresa Bourgeois, as well as Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith and WAMC's Alan Shartok. You are always encouraged to briefly weigh in at panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Don't give us a long-winded treatise on something. Just give us the point. And here comes some now.
Eisenhower said it could be done in a half a page, and we want it in a half a sentence.
Okay. Well, yeah. Let's do that thing.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go. We had about maybe 10,000 letters.
Really?
That pointed out, well, I'm just upping it a bit, that it was Eartha Kitt who criticized Lyndon Johnson.
Okay. There you go.
Lost her career. Okay. But
so did she lose her career doing that?
And she
was impacted. Significantly.
Yeah, and my point is, we have wonderful listeners who listen to every word. And lo be the person who says the wrong thing.
A community of editors to answer
That's
to.
That's right. That's right.
There will be many, many stepping up to the plate.
When I say high-powered instead of semi-automatic or automatic.
And we so appreciate that. Not.
I'm trying to think of Eartha Kitt music.
What?
Be some great
French. Santa Baby.
I would say what I thought was an Eartha Kitt hit, but I don't think it would be a good thing because, you know, somebody would say, no, that was Rosemary Clooney.
No, that was Pat Boone.
Rosemary Clooney. Speaking of Rosemary Clooney,
Howard says, guns, violence. I always wonder what kind of sick minds could walk into a food market in Iraq and other countries, blow themselves and 50 people, other people up. I knew it couldn't happen here in America. We wouldn't do anything like that. But now I realize the school shootings that have gone on and on in this country are our versions of suicide bombers in the Middle East. Our politicians are worthless, says Howard.
I didn't give you the recycle bin. No, I'll do your paperwork for
you. I should tell everybody on the outside who are looking in maybe on, you know, on our streaming.
WAMC.org.
That there's a major intellectual difference between Joe Donahue and Ray Graff.
Ray it's about Graff, 30 IQ points that he's got me.
At least 30, right.
I think it's a procedural
Ray Graff. Ray Graff believes that the place to throw these out when I'm done with them, it should be behind me, and that I shouldn't have to hand them across the desk to he or Joe.
So these are the emails that come in that are printed.
Yes. Thank
and
you
there's a recycle bin. So I like to give you the recycle bin so that they're not handed noisily across the table.
I agree with you.
It makes perfect sense.
Thanks for that clarification.
All right, sir.
Very much appreciate
trying to help.
And the letter writer said?
Oh, all right. Going back to that. Right.
Nothing. Okay, so Mike says, I agree with Alan. Now, this is a good letter already. I have to agree with Alan, given Donald Trump's penchant for changing his mind as often as he changes his socks. We don't know about that. I am skeptical anything will get done. Simon and Garfunkel's line in The Sounds of Silence is appropriate, is apropos, I'm so sorry. People hearing without listening, in quotes. The Donald is a NATO person, no action, talk only, and that's from Mike in Glen Falls.
Glens Falls.
Glen Falls. Now, it is true that the technical name is Glens Falls, but we once had a guy apply for a job right here. And he kept saying, I can do this job. I have a lot of friends in Glen Falls. We kept saying to him, no, there is no Glen Falls. It's Glens Falls. But he kept insisting. So what we did is we put our heads together and said, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. You know what I mean? So forever, it's been Glen Falls around here.
Okay.
Did he get the job?
Yeah.
No.
No.
Okay. No, because there were several women in the room at the time. And this was a long time ago. And he's kept saying, as your girls will tell you.
Ah, oh, that's, yeah, well, that's an immediate disqualifier.
That
yeah.
did it. That yeah. did it.
All right.
Okay, I'm not using names here.
Thank you.
Patrick says, youngsters, the young people speaking up and out sound incredibly bright and articulate. Incredibly so. It gives me some hope for the future. From Patrick.
So me inspiring, too, Patrick.
Absolutely.
Aren't they? They are so inspiring.
And well-organized, absolutely.
Bob says, Trump and bump stocks. Note that Trump's direction to ban bump stocks takes the pressure off Congress to legislate a real solution. In fact, I heard somewhere this morning on one of the many outlets that I listened to in preparation for this panel. are you all right?
Yeah, go ahead.
Did you start to laugh?
When coffee went down the wrong pipe.
I'll bet that's true. So that in fact... It may not be able to be done administratively. It may have to be done through Congress.
Well, it's been done on the state level already. Massachusetts, right. For instance,
yeah.
in the
and
past month.
A good
the
state.
Obama administration had researched and determined that it needed to be done legislatively, that they couldn't do this administratively.
I love having you with us. You are so... You are like going to the 42nd Street Library.
But not like going to 42nd Street.
That's yeah. Right.
Entirely
the litigation.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so thanks for that, Bob. And Cindy says, gun control. Hello, panel.
Hello.
This will be the ultimate breaking point in this administration because they will never do any real action lest they lose their base. We need a multiple disciplinary approach, metal detectors in school, increased access to mental health therapy, universal background checks, and a ban, the AR-15. Only then will our children be safe, and that's Cindy in Royalston, Mass. And Cindy, that's only a beginning. Your list is only a beginning of what needs to be done. There are so many more things.
And, you know, I think as a first step, we need to understand the NRA. As you talked about, Alan, they do not represent gun owners anymore. They represent gun manufacturers.
Right.
And if only responsible gun owners that are NRA members would leave that and join a different organization.
Well, that's interesting that you say that because we had a letter yesterday. I'm not vouching for it. I'm just saying the letter said, why hasn't the NRA been listed as a terrorist organization?
Right.
Right.
Well, it's the Washington Post. If you wonder how much your member of Congress has gotten from the NRA, you can just go to the Washington Post, and they have a map, and you enlisted, you know, John Faso, Congressman Claudia Tenney, Elise Stefanik, whole host of New York State members
Any
of Congress.
Any Democrats on the list?
I'm sure there are.
Okay. Well, maybe we can mention them as well.
You look awfully unhappy, Raymond. Are you okay?
No. Yeah. How can you call the NRA a terrorist organization, though? Really?
Oh, so you really are angry at me for having...
No, not at all. You didn't say that. You didn't write that. I saw that email come in.
Except that I keep telling Rex on the Media Project, I selected that letter to emphasize. Therefore, you know, I have, out of all the letters, I thought that was an important one to select. Don't you see?
Mm-hmm. What's next?
Oh, thank you. From Robert, gun control legislation. Good morning, panel.
Good morning.
Teresa's a little off base on the current gun legislation betting considered. It says betting considered?
Vetting.
Being considered.
Well, it got changed to something that it wasn't intended to. But Robert ought to read his mail before he sent it.
All right. Well,
anyway,
Legislation proposed by John Cornyn in the Senate does not include a nationwide concealed carry element. That's only in the House version, and it may very well be stripped out in the conference negotiation. But it may very well be that a pig will fly through this room. Also, I want to point that out. If the Dems can always filibuster the final bill.
He's right about that, but I don't think that the Trump people said that they were supporting the Cornyn bill.
No, they
just said that they were looking at bump stocks and other measures. And then when they were asked about what the other measures were, one of the things that they talked about was the concealed carry.
And
that they have to make sure that there's enough security in, they're talking about security in schools, which most people think doesn't work. I'm looking for Democrats.
The email address is panel@wamc.org. Teresa Bourgeois is here. Joe Bonilla, Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, and of course you. And we're so happy to have you here on a Wednesday morning at 9:43. 33-year-old attorney fired last year by a prominent international law firm became the fourth person to plead guilty in special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation, admitting Tuesday that he lied to federal investigators about his contacts with a Trump campaign official. Alex van der Zwan, who worked at the law firm Skadden, Arps, Slate, Megan, and Flom.
By the way, that is a huge law firm.
Massive. Mm-hmm.
Very important.
Well, it's tough to say. Skadden, Arps, Slate, Megan, and Flom.
Usually just abbreviated to Skadden, Arps.
Yeah.
Right. Admitted in Washington's federal court Tuesday to making false statements about his interactions with the former Trump campaign aide Rick Gates. His plea deal may allow him to avoid prison. Van der Zwan's plea comes on the heels of an indictment from Mueller last week that charged 13 Russian individuals and three Russian companies in a hidden but robust social media effort that provoked on-the-ground rallies and sought to meddle in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. But the charge against the attorney, who's also the son-in-law of a Russian billionaire, does not involve election meddling or relate to the Trump campaigns or operations. Instead, it stems from the special counsel's investigation into Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign chair, and Gates, who is a longtime business associate of Manafort. We'll parse this, and we'll get our opinions from the panel coming up next on The Roundtable. Welcome back to The Roundtable on WAMC. It's Wednesday morning.
Oh, boy, I was sure Mike on the controls was going to find some Eartha Kitt for us to listen to.
Oh, well, I'm not sure he was even listening, but if there's any Eartha Kitt to be had for your job security, it might be a good idea to find some and put it on. Eartha Kitt. Okay. So as I mentioned before the break, a 33-year-old attorney fired last year is now the fourth person to plead guilty in Robert Mueller's Russia investigation, Alex van der Zwan. He may avoid prison. Anybody have any comments on this?
I do. It seems to me that a good deal of what's going on here by Mueller, the special counsel, is to put pressure on Manafort to turn on this, because it's clearly Manafort who would know the most about the relationship with Trump. And so, therefore, every time you see one of these stories, the idea isn't to put a schmigeggy like this in jail. It is much more to put pressure on Manafort, because this guy might know something about Manafort and what he was doing. So that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think for when I look at it, it's just a matter of, you know, what deals can sort of be reinforced in terms of, backing up this. The charges are still limited to information, right? It's a matter of information. Right. Did you obstruct information, you know, that could lead to certain findings. And it does it add a little bit more fuel, sure, but does it? Yeah, I think it's to me, it's not extremely strong or compelling.
It certainly goes back a ways. This is 2012, 2013. This is not related to what the media has been in a lather over all
right.
this time.
And I think that there's difficulty in staying focused on what's the actual charges and what the language around the indictments versus, you know, what we think could possibly happen, but that's still, you know, a projection.
Well, I think obviously this is a smaller domino and the set of dominoes are going to come down. But again, I think this is all cumulative in terms of what Mueller is ultimately trying to figure out is obviously that link with Manafort and trying to really distill him down to telling us, you know, what the actual truth is about what happened in the campaign in 2016, but also mm-hmm. what led up to that and everything that could be done to influence our electorate to that point.
Right, and to put this into perspective and maybe make that link, Gates and Manafort were indicted last year on charges that they conspired to launder millions of dollars and directed a covert Washington lobbying campaign on behalf of pro-Russian Ukrainian interests. Both of those men have pleaded not guilty.
Mm-hmm. No, I think Gates has turned.
Has he?
I thought they both pleaded not guilty. I think they did. And I think I read in the paper just yesterday or the day before that
he's
cooperating.
Mm. Yeah.
And go ahead.
I think that this does two things. It sends a very clear, loud and clear signal that you do not lie to the investigators.
Yeah, right? No lie to the FBI. Good rule.
Yeah, right. Do not lie. There will be consequences for lying. But it also adds more, you know, thread. They're threading together this connection back to the Russian and the oligarchs and folks closer and closer to Putin. And I think mm-hmm. this is part of the, mm-hmm. as you say, Joe, building that case.
And I think it's a matter of that. Can those threads be woven together to, you know, reinforce, you know, that actual right. connection? And I think it's still going to be quite a challenge to do so, as people just don't want that information to get out. You know, we've seen this historically.
Well, here's an interesting tie-in, and this is much later in this long AP piece on this story. Last year, Van der Zwan married the daughter of Ukrainian-Russian billionaire Herman Khan, according to the Russian editions of Forbes. Khan was born in Kiev, one of Russia's biggest financial and industrial people. Khan and his partners are suing BuzzFeed mm-hmm. over its publication of a dossier of allegations about ties between Trump and Russia. It's a collection of memoranda authored by former British spy Chris Steele, who makes several claims about Alpha Group, and the partners say are false and defamatory. BuzzFeed is fighting that lawsuit. Now, we know Steele's name mm-hmm. because of his work, which was funded in part by the Clinton campaign.
Right.
And initially by the Republicans.
Parts of Steele's work also used in obtaining a secret warrant to monitor Carter Page, a former Trump campaign foreign policy advisor. So there is a tie-in mm-hmm. here.
Is it strong enough? I think that's the bigger question of what's going to shake out in a court.
Right.
The thing is, Raymond, I see what you're trying to do there, but I want to respond to you.
What am I trying to do?
Well,
I'm reporting what
the Democrats did it. That's a Trump line. You know, that they did it. The question on the memo is how much of it was true? See, if it was true and it implicates Trump or Trump's people, that's different than saying, yeah, the Democrats originally did that. Don't you understand the difference?
This is the PP issue?
I want the what issue?
This is the dossier about the...
Yeah. What did you say?
The PP issue?
What do you mean, PP?
Never mind. Good Lord.
I want to go to the always serious Teresa for some background on this.
She's not even listening. She's zoned out like 20
minutes
ago. Well,
she's like a 42nd Street library. You put the thing in the tube. The tube goes upstairs. They take it out. They send the thing back.
It didn't come
down.
Back. Right?
No. I don't know what you meant about this. The dossier. I mean, I think the dossier
you know,
people.
Ray tried to confuse the waters here.
Right, but Ray also begins with the Democrats funded the dossier, but he forgets
in part.
That, he forgets that the first step, he and all the conspiracy theorists forget that in the first instance, it was the Republicans who were funding Steele to collect this information. So
but it's not a Democrat-Republican issue. I'm just making.
Well, you tried to make it into one.
I'm not at all.
I do think it's relevant.
Funded in part by the Democrats.
I do think that it's relevant. And that's what I was talking about, this thread, that he is the son-in-law of a Russian businessman. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that's not an insignificant, that familial connection is not insignificant in this activity. But I think the bigger issue yesterday was this notion of Trump, you know, saying that he did more to address the Russia issue than Obama. And then Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
That press conference
Oof. Was just stunning. At what point, you know, how many times can she continue to lie? But also one of the things, as I read it, it brings up the fact that it exposes Senator McConnell on this. He is not going to be thought, you know, history is not going to treat this man well. Clearly, President Obama, you know, the Trump people are saying, oh, well, President Obama didn't do enough. Well, he did a whole host of things, but he also went to the Republicans and said, this is a bipartisan problem. Let's do this together. And McConnell said no. And Ryan said no. We're not going to together speak out against Russian interference with our election.
Right, because they all in the pursuit of winning in their regards, probably. Because
This was pre-vote.
Right.
Pre-election. And they all let any sanctions lapse that could have been imposed.
Absolutely.
And so, Ray?
Yes.
Why haven't the Trump folks implemented the sanctions that got strong bipartisan support?
I guess you'd have to ask them. I'm merely the moderator of this discussion. Our email address is panel@wamc.org, and we have some letters.
Okay, Ray, I'll read them now. Tom Thumb, T-H-O-M.
Tom Thumb.
Thumb.
I'll be darned.
Says, we already have armed teachers, why not? We already have armed security and police in some schools. If a teacher is willing to go through the licensing, training, and expense, we should allow them. This would likely be the most effective deterrent. I knew this guy named Umansky when I taught at the John Jay College, which was mostly cops. And they came in, and one guy was clearly, and Umansky tells a story about how this guy was, it was in print, by the way, how this guy was clearly, you know, in some kind of alcoholic thing or something like that. And he was fiddling with his gun, as Umansky, who was a well-known left-wing sociology teacher or history teacher, was going on. And when he left, Umansky said to the group, hey, did you see that? That guy was fooling with his weapon when I was up there. And the guy said, don't worry, teach, we had him covered.
Huh.
Is that a benevolent?
Just go with the flow, panel.
Yeah, well, I mean,
Is that a benevolent?
But that goes back to, like, obviously, you know, the only way to fight guns is with guns. That doesn't work. That never has worked.
No. And not to mention, I mean, we had a case recently where there was a police officer in, I believe it was Brooklyn, who had a gun. He was in giving a presentation, and a child was able to fire it off. And
that's,
you know,
a
there's
problem.
A whole lot of liability. Is school, who are taxpayers going to be expected to pay for those insurances? There's a lot. It's very complex to you know, it's one thing to issue that theory, but it's another thing to really back it up and ensure, you know, the safety and risk. I think if you asked any school's legal counsel whether this is a good move,
our legal counsel doesn't want me to bring a gun to work either, for that matter.
No, neither do I. But
I don't want you either.
It's so wonderful to have an education reporter for the Berkshire Eagle with us, who has clearly thought this thing through. So thank you very much.
That's great. Careful, because the other shoe's about to drop, Jen. Just saying.
But you always think that if I say something nice to someone...
Let me tell you how many shoes drop on me every week.
Right.
That there will always be another thing.
Yes, that is what I'm saying.
Okay, I admit, in your case, it's true.
There it is.
But how many teachers that you interview do you think would want... I mean, my parents were both teachers. They would not want guns
in the classroom. And we have a school principal who's a firearms instructor down at the Farmington River Regional School, elementary school. And, you know, I think you would have some who would be for it. I mean, I grew up in the hill towns where a lot of people, you know, farm folks had and hunters. Mm-hmm. You know, I have friends who in the local school systems grew up where it was part of your after school activity. You'd bring your gun to school, you'd lock it up in your locker, and then after school you'd go out hunting. You know, it's part of our legacy.
But
of
there was
our
education with taking care of
and,
a gun.
And there's education. And I mean, right. there are gun courses that are not taught by the schools, but school facilities are used to teach firearm safety courses, their classrooms, and that's one thing. But I think if you're going, you know, it becomes a union issue if you're asking, if you're mandating teachers to carry.
Have you interviewed that guy? That teacher?
Which teacher?
The one who was the firearms instructor.
I have not yet.
That's a good story, don't you think?
It is.
All right. I
but
like my cut.
You know, but to be armed for the purpose of protecting the kids is different than to be a teacher who is interested in, you know, using a gun for hunting or whatever. That's to be armed for the purpose of protecting
right.
the students in your classroom is
right.
a whole
I think. I mean, we have enough issues just alone in schools, liability with restraints. You know, we saw that in the Eagleton school case, how that was abused. And I think that that to legitimately, you know, enforce a law or to have...
You make a very good point.
Yeah.
I mean, if those guys who, many of whom were in serious trouble at the Eagleton school for mm-hmm. abusing students or punishing them, mm-hmm. What if the guy had a gun? You know, we talk about this all the time, you know, that the idea that if somebody has a gun, something terrible can happen there. What are you making signals about, Ray?
I just think you're fantastic. But we'll take a short break here. The email is panel@wamc.org. We'll get back to more of your letters and more topics here with Jen Smith, Teresa Bourgeois, Joe Badia, and Alan Shartok. It's the Roundtable on WAMC. We'll be back.
C'est si bon. De partie n'importe où, bras dessus, bras dessous, en chantant des chansons. C'est si bon de se dire des mots doux, de petits rien du tout.
Ah yes, Wayne Newton here on the Roundtable, 10:05, and no, that was Eartha Kitt, and well done to Michael, our engineer, who gets to keep his job, yeah?
Bravo.
Good job, Michael.
Huh?
What are you saying?
He's saying something to us. Oh, Sarah got it. Sarah got it. Well, you can still stay here.
Take the credit.
That's fine.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Well, that's very nice. The panel here is Jen Smith, very glib. Joe Bonilla is here, Teresa Bourgeois, and Alan Shartok, and of course you at panel@wamc.org. And we have more letters.
Oh, we do.
Anything worth a darn?
I want to hear from teachers at school vacation.
Okay.
Right?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It says Tom. It appears ironic that most of the panel most of the time is promoting political discord, just like Russia was trying to do with their bots. Support for the current fairly elected administration would be a refreshing change. At least say something nice sometime about our president. Thank you. And that's from Tom.
All right. Everybody say something nice. Teresa, you first.
I will first. Okay. Ready?
Alan, go.
Something nice.
There you go.
All right, let's go on.
All right, here we go. Please.
Uh-oh. You want to say something?
Did somebody want to say something? Okay.
I don't think it's sowing discord to
tell the truth.
It's insight. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Tell the truth. Yeah. Lee says, on this spring-like morning,
yes.
Irresistibly, my 60 self is bursting forth in this current state of affairs. Our do-nothing Congress will soon take its recess. I propose that if then they have accomplished nothing significant on gun control on national scale, we should descend on the Capitol to begin a blockade, preventing the so-called legislators, in quotes, from returning to the halls of government locked out until the people they claim to represent can vote them out. Maybe it's easier for our children on the streets of Washington than it is sitting at their desks, and that's Lee and Modena. And Mark says of gun control. Those in favor of gun control say assault weapons should be banned. They already are. Also, please don't try to tell law-abiding gun owners what they do or don't need when you've served in the military. You've never served in the military. Never give hunting or had any training in weapons, and that's from Mark in Amsterdam.
Well, what?
Wendy says, panel, the domestic violence analogy is very good. Most mass shooters do not meet the legal or medical standard of mental illness. I believe it's only 5%. They are angry people. The mental illness discussion is very useful for the NRA, but it is a straw man argument. As long as the guns are out there, there will be mass shootings. Australia, Australia, Australia. Anybody get that? Or no, there are no guns in Australia?
They had a mass shooting in Australia. They imposed a whole range of restrictions, mm-hmm. Primarily background checks and such. Didn't take people's guns away. They just had restrictions. And they have not had a mass shooting.
Elaine says, school shootings. I listen every day to the roundtable, but since the recent Florida school shootings, I've heard nothing from Betsy DeVos. If I missed it, please let us know what her thoughts are. Thank you. Anybody know?
Yeah, after her initial tweet, we have not heard much from
what was her initial tweet,
Betsy. You know, her, you know, hearts go out to thoughts and prayers,
condolences.
Just look at their budget. That's their response. Their response is in their budget, deeply cutting funding for school safety programs, mental health programs in the schools.
Eve says of the FBI, hello panel, please help. Just what could the FBI have done about the shooter in Florida? He had not committed a crime. What are they allowed to do in advance of a crime? And that's Eve in Rexford. Well, I don't know the state laws there, but Teresa, I see you have something to say.
Well, just from my experience working on violence in Boston, what the FBI would then is notify local officials and bring it to their attention. And so, but this person was already brought to their attention. So even though they've said it was a mistake on their part, I'm not sure what they, if it would have made a difference.
Audrey on gun control. I never understand why murder is so sanitized in this country. Gun owners should go to crime scenes and actually see what the damage looks like or be required to see a victim's autopsy. This isn't the game. The victims at Newtown averaged 11 bullet wounds per person. How would anyone want to contribute to the gun culture after seeing the carnage? And that's from Joan. All right.
I'm not sure if that would necessarily work. That's my feeling with that. I think, you know, we do have a lot of media out there that does show violence and things like that. You see it scared straight in terms of prisons, but I don't know necessarily if that would work or not for some of these folks.
Well, you know, Joe, I've mentioned this before, but Eisenhower in Germany made the town residents come to the concentration camp to look at the bodies and everything else. I don't think it would hurt.
It wouldn't hurt, but when you have these immersive games like Call of Duty and things like that, I think that's where it becomes way too real for folks. And when they see a real scene, they may not necessarily be able to tell the difference between real and fake. They might just think it's a Hollywood scene.
I see. Thomas says, Common, why would Manafort turn? He will be pardoned by POTUS when the time comes. That's probably true.
Doesn't he have to be convicted to be pardoned?
No, you do not. You can pardon in advance. You can say pardon for any crimes you may have committed.
Right.
Okay.
So there you are. Okay. Glad you asked the question.
Thank you very much.
Thomas says, rearming teachers. Dear panel, has anyone thought about the psychological effect on the teacher trained to be a helper, not a killer, who is then asked to, quote, take down a person who they may perhaps know? We hear of soldiers who carry with them for the rest of their lives the trauma of having killed other young men. This could ruin the rest of the teacher's life. Thank you, Raymond. Keith says, Alpha Bank had servers in the Trump Tower and spies. Good morning, panel.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Alpha Bank was the bank that unexplained computer servers in Trump Tower sending and receiving weird traffic to Russia that bank servers don't use. Alpha Bank was also the bank that had three Russian spies that were convicted and expelled in a previous espionage case in New York, and that's from Keith.
All right.
One more.
All right, what the heck?
Do you want another one?
Whatever. Sure. Absolutely. Like yes, one more, please.
Okay, you're the boss. Manafort, Russia. Hello, panel. Two quick things. First, Mueller will not try to flip Manafort because Manafort may be the only guy mixed up in this who is dirtier than Trump. Second, of course, McConnell and Ryan did not want to expose the Russian interference on behalf of the GOP candidate. They're a family, remember? Party before country. And that's from Marty.
And thank you. And the email address is panel@wamc.org. Louisville has been stripped of its 2013 men's basketball title and will have to vacate 123 victories, along with millions in conference revenue from the 2012 to 2015 NCAA tournaments. The NCAA Infraction Appeals Committee says the association has the authority to take away championships for what it considers major rule violations. Have you been following this, Alan?
None at all.
It also refuted Louisville's position that the NCAA exceeded its boundaries and didn't follow its own precedent. The punishment follows an embarrassing sex scandal involving former basketball staffer Andre McGee, who was accused of hiring an escort and other dancers to strip and have sex with recruits. It's the first time a Division I men's basketball program has been stripped of a national title.
Well, I mean, this is the first time it's happened in basketball at the college level. Obviously, it's happened in football with Penn State in 2011, where you had all their victories from 98 to 2011 were all vacated. Joe Paterno's level from being the winningest coach at the NCAA to whatever he might be. But yeah, there's precedent for this. And I think it's another telltale sign that this sort of behavior will never be tolerated.
Yeah, it absolutely needs to be done. Because if you don't do it, then all the rules and the laws are, you know, for naught.
Right.
You know, I think that it taps into... I don't think there will be as much change until it taps into the bigger issues of privilege and, you know, what we tend to sweep under the rug in terms of, you know, you're going to college to learn, supposedly.
Not if you're at a big-time basketball program.
I went to Syracuse University, so I know exactly how that goes. And there's, you know, vast inequities. When you have, if you look at the 2015 reports of when this case first came out, you know, you had the escort saying, "I felt like I was part of the recruiting team." You know, that's a fundamental ethical issue.
Exactly.
Those are the bigger issues you need to address. It doesn't matter if you take away titles and things. You know, the money was still made and pocketed and spent since then.
By individuals, but the college will have to fork back at least $600,000, maybe much more than that.
Right, and who does that hurt? You know, does that hurt the current students who are non-athletes there? Does it hurt the athletic students? Does it hurt administrators there? Will that just go to, you know, further increase debt for legal fees? You know,
right.
This is something that could have been prevented if, you know, it just didn't happen, if it wasn't supported. Obviously, people knew about what was going on. And so this action is, yeah, it's trying to take a stand. But, you know, will we see something like this again? Will we see privilege given to athletes? You know, there's allegations of athletes getting, you know, being paid as recruits out there.
Should they be paid?
Will that change? You know, should you pay a student who's extremely smart, who could excel in physics and?
But that doesn't bring the college millions and millions of dollars. The bigger
exactly.
question is: should these big time college football or basketball players be paid? And we've had that discussion on Vox Pop in the past. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Alan?
I don't know. I think not. In general, I think not.
No.
Not a good idea.
No? Teresa?
No. I think there's just, stating the obvious, there's a huge amount of money in college sports, basketball, football, and there are all sorts of pressures. I don't know the right way to deal with the disparity, but these young people, many of them often from middle or low-income backgrounds, generate enormous amount of money for the schools. Now, they do get a scholarship, but they don't get paid. They don't get compensated in any way. I can't figure out a fair way to do it. But there has to be some way to take this pressure off. And how do you inject some basic ethics in all of this?
And
I mean, there's basic right and wrong. And Adidas, you know, allegedly paying $100,000 to a potential recruit, it's a cesspool that needs to be cleaned up.
It doesn't help them in the long run either. No. I think, you know, a lot of these young people who there's no required, you know, financial budget management classes, so they'll blow through the money like right away, and then in the end they find themselves back in the status that they were,
if not worse, know,
recruited, if not worse. And so I think there is a matter of ethics and social responsibility when it comes to that. But I think because we've had this history where it's evolved, college sports has evolved to, you know, be an industry, essentially. But there's no regulations really articulated across the board about it. I mean, yeah, you have NCAA guidelines and things like that, just like, you know, Massachusetts has MIAA. But, you know, what does that do for the long run for the benefit of anyone?
But these...
and you've already knocked down students who tried to, student athletes who tried to unionize. You know, that name never came forth. And so that was a call to say that they needed protections in some regards because they were treated differently than, you know, the rest of their peers.
Well, the colleges would say this benefits us and all the other students because it allows us to pump lots of money into all these other things that wouldn't ordinarily get the money, physics
really?
And all these.
It doesn't trickle down.
In theory, that could happen.
Yeah, look how much, I mean, how many of the coaches get paid more than the president or the top researchers or the top other folks at these.
These multi-million dollar deals.
But I'm not going to watch on New Year's Eve, I'm not going to watch a physics experiment. I'm going to watch the football championship.
You're using against physics right now, don't you?
No, don't get me wrong. I love physics. What I'm saying is it's not a spectator sport.
No, but I mean, you know, when you have other programs in academia, they still bring in revenue, whether it's through grant funding and things like that. Those programs should still be supported, but the problem is that we put this pedestal on college sports that we need to really begin to wean back off.
You can't make the argument that the money that athletics is pulling in is benefiting the college as a whole. I think it's benefiting a small sector of that.
Well, the email address here is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org.
Molly says, teachers on vacation. I heard that you want to hear from teachers on vacation. I happen to be sitting in my classroom listening as I grade my papers on vacation. I'm doing this because I had to address the idea of what happened in Florida with my students on Thursday. I couldn't function right by Friday. High schoolers are very, very well spoken when it comes to ideas of gun control. Sometimes people like to dismiss their ideas because they are young, but they're the ones who are on the front line, quite literally, and that's from Molly in Clifton Park.
Thanks, Molly.
Have your teacher or your students write letters to the editor and share those.
Go down to Albany and check with their legislators. Yeah. What's their position? State legislature, what is their mayor's position? What's their county leader's position on these issues?
Timothy says, when Steele hired by Fusion GPS, Ms. Bourgeois was incorrect about the hiring sequence of Christopher Steele. It is significant that Steele was not hired by Fusion GPS until after Fusion's conservative client, the Washington Examiner, had left the scene. Thank you, and that's from Timothy. I didn't understand it. Did you? No. Okay, well, we didn't get it. Sorry. Gail says, guns in school? I can't believe you're talking about guns in schools and arming teachers. What kind of country do you want us to be? How is standing militia different from a standing army? And according to the Second Amendment, should we have both? Gail, let's be fair about this. We are not espousing guns in schools. We're talking about a serious motion from people to have guns in school. So when you say, I can't believe you're talking about it, that would not be right, in my opinion, because we talk about everything here, but we don't endorse it.
All right, steady.
That's enough?
It's all right.
You think I'm overdoing
it? It's okay.
It? You don't think I should criticize?
Steady, old boy. Steady.
All right. Jim says, Australia had compulsory gun confiscation. Just to correct a comment from earlier, Australia did confiscate guns. Derek says, teachers with guns.
They didn't confiscate hunters.
They didn't do that, right?
Yeah, automatic weapons that they then put restrictions on. Right, but not.
Derek says, teachers with guns. Hi, panel.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I was a middle school and high school teacher for over 12 years. There's no way I would accept the responsibility or liability associated with carrying a gun while teaching. Most teachers I know would have no part in carrying at work, even those who own guns. Not to mention the teacher union would never allow this. It's a non-starter. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for writing.
Bill says, panel, regardless of whether Steele dossier is completely true, partially true, or a complete fallacy, it was the work of the dark state. Both major parties are acolytes of moneyed interests that, for the most part, control the political discussion. Trump's pseudo-populist campaign was a threat to those interests. As it turns out, he is an associate member of that club. His only threat was stirring up awareness of his secretive compadre's agenda for America. Bill.
And thank you for all your emails today, and we appreciate it very much. I don't know if you saw this link from studyfinds.org. Too much stress. The average American has 60 bad days a year, study finds.
That's low for me.
Researchers.
It's the opposite for you. How about that?
Researchers commissioned a poll of nearly 2,000 working Americans about how they felt with stress, hoping to learn more about what constituted a bad day. Respondents on average indicated they had 60 bad days a year, with 80% of these 24-hour periods being made at least partially unpleasant by work-related stress. What do you say to that, boss?
Oh, boy. If you only know.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, I sit in the office, the door is closed, knock, knock. Somebody says, can I come in? I always say, no. You cannot come in because you're either going to ask for a raise or you're going to say you're leaving. Don't you see? That's why you say no.
Right. So you prevent the bad days from happening by not listening to your
Don't listen to your employees. Prevention that's the number one rule
that's
of management.
That's right.
Illness, financial worries, canceled plans, and feeling unclean or disheveled also had the ability to ruin someone's day.
What are you looking at me for?
I'm not. Oh no, I'm reading here.
The angle is a little skewed.
I see your
right
eyes looking at
me. Meanwhile, a comparatively small percentage of respondents, 8%, said that their day could be wrecked by their favorite sports team losing a game.
Well, that's why always the Monday after the Super Bowl is always the day that people take off from work.
So, how many bad days do you think you have, Jack Smith, a year?
I'm probably the wrong person to ask because I'm a hopeful optimist.
Oh, cut it out. How about you, Joe? Well,
it depends on the season.
I get cranky.
It depends. Yeah, well, it depends on the season. Usually in the winter and the fall, it's a little bit rougher. It depends on the workload, you know. But
Teresa?
Yeah, but one of the things that Joe does for a living is he has clients and they come to him and they say, oh boy, we stepped into something.
Yeah, we're having a bad
all
day.
Hours of the day.
Yeah. And so that can't be that easy.
It's not a bad day. It's the norm.
Teresa, how many bad days a year do you have?
You know, as few as possible. But one of the things I talked about was you need more sleep. And I absolutely agree with that.
Yeah.
I just,
critical.
You know, I live exhausted. Yeah. And I just,
me too.
If I could just get more sleep, I'd have more good days. But, you know, I try to have as many. You know, every day has something good in it.
Yes.
Three good things happen every day. I try to.
Is it that you don't have time for sleep or you can't sleep?
I don't have time for sleep.
Okay, we're about out of time. Alan, how many bad days a year for you?
Oh, God.
How many bad days do you create and how many bad
days
do you have?
You create 364.
You are so
what about
right.
Those
you
other,
are so right.
You know,
you're all right.
We're out of time.
We're all lucky.
I'm going to bang the gavel and we'll call this panel to a close. I want to thank you all for being here. Jen Smith, Joe Bonilla, Teresa Bourgeois, and Alan Shartok. Hey, thank you for listening. The Roundtable, by the way, continues. We'll be back.